Here's Woody Allen. First, he'll read works by Damon Runyon and Damon Runyon Jr.
My dear son, these are your instructions for the disposal of my remains, and you are not to permit anyone to dissuade you from them on any grounds. Have Campbell's, take charge of body immediately on being advised of my death. No funeral services, no display of my body, no flowers. I desire that my body be cremated and any ashes scattered without publicity over the island of Manhattan, the place I have truly loved and that was so good to me. I think you can get Captain Eddie Rickenbacker of Eastern Airways to get his boys to perform this service for me. If you like, you may have my name added to the stone over your mother's grave in the family plot at Woodlawn. I have often expressed these wishes about my disposition, so there is nothing new about them, save as addressed to you personally, in affection, Dad. P.S., there is a copy of these instructions in my box and at the vault in the Chase Manhattan Bank at 57th Street. My father's expressed hope was that he would be in a happy state if he woke up dead and found himself at a big poker game with his departed pals, Tad Dorgan, Sid Mercer, Matty Matthewson, Hype Igo, and all the rest. He hoped, my father said, that they would have held a seat open for him. December 18, 1946, my wife and I went secretly to Campbell's, where I was handed a bulky package wrapped in brown paper tied with thick twine, carefully prepared to conceal the shape. Inside was a heavy bronze urn containing the ashes of Damon Runyon. At Eastern Airlines headquarters in Rockefeller Center, we met Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. From LaGuardia Airport, we went up in a big twin-engine transport with Chief Pilot John F. Gill at the controls, along with co-pilot Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, both of whom had known my father. Rickenbacker, my wife and I, with the urn on my lap, sat in bucket seats in the rear of the plane. The ship droned north and banked over Woodlawn. Then it bore through the dreary day down the Hudson River and turned at 3,000 feet over the Statue of Liberty. Captain Rickenbacker took the urn and went forward to the co-pilot's seat on the right of the cockpit. I stood right behind, bent over in the little companionway. The plane steadied north over Broadway. Captain Rickenbacker tied the wrapping twine from his wrist to the heavy bronze container as insurance against the slip. At Times Square, I nodded, and Captain Rickenbacker tipped the urn out the cockpit window. Nothing was said aloud. False alarm. The voice talked about the city. It was a radio announcer's voice, and I resented its clean diction and its wheedling salesmanship. The voice of warning spoke to the people of the city as though it were trying to sell them a laxative, a tube of toothpaste, a cake of soap, or a pack of cigarettes. It was a cold voice, aloof and precise, and I knew the announcer had spent a lot of time with vocal teachers. The voice told the people of the city to stay off the streets, to be calm, to remain in their homes until the all clear had sounded. The voice said unidentified planes had been spotted beating toward the city. Those planes, I thought, are coming to bomb my family and my friends, to try and destroy the city I love. We sat there in the barracks waiting to go on guard, and we cursed the planes, and I felt angry and helpless. I love the city beyond all places. I'm not a man for country places, and the choir of the crickets annoys me late at night because I want to hear the roaring ebb and flow of Broadway. I like to hear the L trains in the distance, and even after they tore down the structure, I used to listen for them and feel sad when I couldn't hear their rolling clatter. The noise a brook makes is not for me. I want the music in the Stork Club. I see more beauty in the lights of the city than I do in the stars in the sky. I want to see the dawn in the windows of the Empire State Building. All the hills in the world can't stir me the way the big buildings do. It was a false alarm. The planes never came. But that polite radio announcer's voice pronouncing the warning made me hate the enemies of democracy more than anything else ever will. I'd always thought of war being fought in strange lands, in parched fields, or in faraway mud. I thought of it as something that happened to remote cities where other people lived. Although I've always thought our life and our property were in jeopardy, I never imagined New York under fire. I do now. I think of my family and my friends in the city I love every time I take a rifle in my hands and every time I fix my bayonet. As the warning voice droned in Sam Levinson's radio, I thought of Mr. Durkin, who lived in our house on Hudson Street when I was a child. He was a bricklayer, stooped from troweling mortar. I thought of him on a thin ladder in the skeleton of a building. I thought of the ladder buckling and breaking and Mr. Durkin falling. I remembered him coming home mangled and bandaged and how difficult it was to get the stretcher up the narrow stairs. I thought how hard Mr. Durkin worked to build these edifices, which are the symbol of our civilization. I thought of the pride he had in them. I remembered him on a Sunday afternoon taking me by the hand and showing me one, the white strips still crossed on the windows, the dust from the bricks rising in a fog about the foundation. I thought of the sweat and the blood Mr. Durkin had put into these buildings. I thought of the architect's dreams. A single plane coming out of the mist at Sandy Hook could destroy all that Mr. Durkin worked for and had pride in. One bomb might fall, and all the skill and strength, all the living and the dying, all the sweat and the beauty and the dream would vanish, and the winter wind would carry the dust away. I thought of that, and I thought of those who snickered at the likes of me. They mocked the pieces I wrote about the Army. They said I was a sucker because I stayed in when I was over 28 and could have gone out. They were the isolationists, and they said we were a people apart, and we were immune to invasion and fire. What did they say then? What did they think? What was in their minds as the announcer's voice spoke the warning? Did they say these buildings would not fall, these people will not die, this city will not be bombed? Did they say we are the people apart then? I hope they said, we are wrong and we admit it. We are a united people now and we must make up for what we did. We were guilty, we will work for forgiveness. In my outfit, most of the guys are from the city. They telephoned their families, and they were angrily glad the warning had been false. But on the field, as we went through a bayonet drill, the non-coms didn't have to drive us. We grunted with pleased exertion as we made the long thrust and the short thrust and the jab. The war had come to the city, and we were part of the city. It's Jimmy Cannon, 1943, by the same author. Nobody asked me, but chorus girls working in their first shows like to wear their stage makeup in the street. Anyone who can drink whiskey out of a paper cup qualifies for Alcoholics Anonymous. Tapping a cigarette on the back of the hand is a habit of incompetent actors. I never heard a funny ventriloquist. A pearl necklace gives most women the quality of piety even when they use eyeshadow. Roasting chestnuts smell better than they taste. What's more out of place than a slave bracelet on a fat man? Chicken pot pie served without crust is stew and should be so described on the menu. Any big city detective will tell you that bookmakers make the most loyal stool pigeons. Candidates who sing hillbilly songs while running for public office should be automatically taken off the ballot. Neat cab drivers are the hostile ones. Did you ever hear anyone bragging about Cincinnati being a good town? It's the only city in the country where the locals are absolutely neutral. Guys who chew on unlit cigars have a tough time convincing me they're telling the truth. Nehru was the only man who didn't look as though he were dressed up for a costume ball when he put on a Nehru jacket. Chances are the lady's miserable if she wears a heart-shaped locket she bought herself. Men with high freckled foreheads favor small knots in their ties. I don't trust guys who make a strong case in an argument and then fold up with, I guess you're right, if they're challenged. Some of the wisest men I know are bad spellers. I've heard people brag about how they enjoy walking in the rain or in snow, but never mention sleet. The higher the girl's heels, the skinnier her legs figure to be. Anytime someone says, can you give me a few minutes of your time, lay a price, he wants a favor. Belt sizes appear to vary with the manufacturer. Why do people live in Ogden, Utah, if they can make a living someplace else? I can't remember ever having stayed for the end of a movie in which the actors wore togas. Spanish music is the only kind I like played on guitars. Why do performers bother to put on toupees when they call your attention to them with jokes? And finally, a little piece, short piece by John Lardner. New York is a town in which pet cats sit in apartment windows gnashing their teeth at pigeons they can never catch. where there is a colony of gypsies and a colony of Mohawk Indians, where men who have never seen South Bend, Indiana, do snake dances in Leon and Eddie's the night before a Notre Dame football game. Last month, a youth proposed to a girl on the Williamsburg Bridge, and the girl said no. The youth climbed on a girder and threatened to jump. The girl ran to a telephone to call the police. "There's a man trying to jump off the George Washington Bridge," she cried. She had the wrong bridge by 10 miles, but the cops noted the location of the call and went to the right bridge and saved the youth. If they'd gone to the George Washington Bridge, they'd have found love and adventure there, too. It's a wonderful town. Thank you.
Woody Allen recorded last night at the Town Hall in Manhattan in a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. This is Fresh Air.